Hello, I'm Nicholas Barrett.
And Nicholas Poitier.
And I'm Maria de Merzes.
And welcome back to The Sound of Economics. Today we're doing a very kind of special and different episode where we're going to talk about the last 10 years of economics. So we're going to start by discussing how economics changed the world over the last decade. Then we're going to discuss the most important slash interesting economics books of the last decade. And then we're going to talk about how the world has changed economics over the last 10 years. So it's very hard to know even where to start here because it's quite a broad subject. I remember in 2009, I enrolled at university, and before I went, my dad said, oh yeah, it's good that you're going to university now because you won't have to deal with the job market in this Great Recession.
Oh dear.
As if it would all be over by 2012. And I suppose I was thinking that since then, one of the things that I think has changed that has been the most significant is you've seen the way people's perception of economics has changed policy and politics so much, and that very much about 10 years ago, most policy in most political parties would be very concentrated on economic growth, deficits, and so on. And now we've come to we've come almost full circle where those things are kind of secondary, and we have other issues have kind of overtaken that in Europe and around the world. Maria, what do you think stood out in the last 10 years?
Yeah, we're going to talk about the way that the outside world has changed economics in the third part of your introduction. Mm-hmm. But for the beginning, I mean, what is differently in economics now out there than it was in the previous decade? I think that we are still very much seeing reactions to the legacy of the crisis.
4.5% generally across these markets.
I think it's fair to say that while we might not be in crisis mode, we still have legacies out there that need to be resolved. They're not going to be done in 1 or 2 years. They need probably a couple of decades before they come back into some sort of a normality. I think the very big difference between now and previous to that would be sort of our appetite for regulation. The 80s, the 90s were years where there was clearly an appetite for deregulation on the financial sector, but more broadly than that. Then came sort of the buildup of imbalances in the early 2000s, and then the breakup of the imbalances. And now the appetite in the public, but certainly also in policy, is to go back into some sort of regulation. And you see that with the way we regulate banks, with the way we aim to regulate digital economy, data protection. There is a clear appetite for more regulation, more protection, more control over what businesses do. I think that's where we are. We're riding a wave of more regulation.
Looking back to the beginning of 2010, if you could see or imagine or foresee or someone told you that the global economy would be the way it is now, would you be happy with that?
Well, in 2010, we were in the middle of the biggest crisis, hopefully in one's lifetime. So I think it would have been very difficult to predict how quickly we could come out of it. So, you know, you can argue, in 2020, do you think you're going to be out of the crisis? At the time, it would have been very difficult to see 2 years ahead, let alone 10 years ahead. I think where we are now is a good point in terms of having reacted to imbalances that were quite clearly unhealthy for us. Could we have done better? Probably. But I think we're in the way of correcting for important distortions that were building up for a long time. What I do also think is, however, that we need to change the way that we have sort of approach our economic models across the world and also our interdependencies, and that we're in the middle of.
Nicholas, when you think historians look back at the last decade in terms of economics, what do you think they'll remember? What do you think they'll talk about?
Probably China, US-China.
We have a $500 billion deficit, trade deficit with China. We're going to turn it around.
I'm a trade guy, so maybe that's my glasses, my view on things. But I think the one thing that, I mean, the obvious thing is what Maria already said, is kind of like the financial crisis. And I think this kind of overshadows everything else. I think in terms of structural change, I think we can see this decade as a big shift in the way the US and also Europe is conducting international policy and international economic policy. And this whole trade war that we have now, this whole WTO debate that we have now, I think if you look back in the late last decade, there was, before the financial crisis, obviously, there was a lot of optimism. There was Obama elected. Everyone was very excited about it.
America, we have come so far. We have seen so much, but there's so much more to do.
there was like this idea that US would become maybe more like Europe, that might be more social, more world-based, more internationalist, and the opposite happened. And I guess history moves in cycles, so who knows what comes after Trump. But so I think there is, this is like a significant change to the...
If I was to put it a little bit broader than that, because I think you're making a very good point there, is this issue of you know, has open and global trade really benefit humankind? I think that's really, we are questioning that. And we are questioning it because circumstances have forced us to question it. And the politics, of course, has got a lot more polarized. And actually, you know, this process of deglobalization, if I may call it this way, which is effectively what you're describing, Niklas, is one that, you know, is probably on the way right now. And is it something that, you know, is going to continue? Or can we sort of, you know, assume 10 years from now when you ask us again, that open and global trade will continue? And I think that's a very big question mark.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because even at the height of the global financial crisis, 2007-2008, it felt like trade wasn't particularly politicized at all. And now it's extremely politicized. And I don't think many economists saw that coming. They thought it had been kind of, it was now a technocratic, academic area of discussion and debate, and something that could be tweaked into perfection over time, and people didn't expect it to become politicized. And I guess even if you look at statistics, we can see that statistically, free trade has made people's lives a lot better. It's made goods cheaper. It's helped employ hundreds of thousands of people, perhaps millions. It's certainly helped bring millions of people in the developing world out of poverty. But in the West, among the middle class, if you remember the famous elephant chart, many people, they just don't feel like they have control over their communities and their lives. And it's interesting that there's this disconnect between the material the material benefits that trade has brought to people and the fact that people just don't feel it.
Well, I think the issue here is much about who has trade benefited. I mean, if you took like averages, then I think you're right. I mean, the benefits of trade have been enormous. But I think what people are reacting to, and in some way I think they're justified to, is that those benefits, big though they were not felt by all. So there were clear, you know, winners of globalization, but also clear losers of globalization, and not giving sufficient attention to the distribution of those gains, of this extra value that has been created, is backfiring.
Yeah, and I believe before the financial crisis, there was always the sense as an economist you should care about this. Is maybe a question more for the later debate, but there was always a sense of we should care about growth. The it's the thing that lifts our boat, the flood that lifts our boat, or the tide. And I think this kind of logic that we had before, that actually we just have to decrease trade impediments and then growth will come and everyone will be better off, this logic has kind of stopped with the financial crisis probably mostly. Yeah. And since then, this distributional question has become a center. And then the logic that we see now in the politics is very zero sum. It's me against you. And this is the logic of the trade war. And I think that's...
Yeah, I would say that on the left, people question whether growth is more important than equality, inequality in the environment, whereas on the right, people question whether growth is more important than, say, employment and sovereignty. And there aren't that many people left who are still arguing that growth is this significant thing that, you know, the tide that raises all boats, I think is the old phrase, isn't it? And that belief has gone, really. I think part of it, I can speak from a British perspective, and perhaps it applies to the rest of Europe, is that there is a school of thought that says that kind of austerity policies sort of severed the link between economic growth and people's experience of the economy. So that once you have reductions in public services, which basically affect the quality of life across the board, even if the economy is growing, people don't really feel it, especially if their standard of living is kind of stagnating and wages are stagnating. Who exactly is feeling that economic growth? And it feels like to a lot of people that it's actually a very small elite. And part of that perception is that the economists and the politicians and the owners, the champions of industry, have basically facilitated this system for their own benefit, and that it's not really for ordinary people. And that wouldn't have been a very popular opinion 10 years ago, or maybe it would have become a very popular opinion 10 years ago, but certainly not 12 years ago.
It's very easy to politicize this issue, right? And on either side of the political spectrum, there would be good reasons to be against, but also good reasons to be for it. To the extent that we here at Bruegel try to be sort of, factual and sort of apoliticized, I think it's important to also question the idea that whether you can talk about sustainable development only if you look at averages. And it's like, is it sustainable to simply aim for growth, or sustainable growth can only happen if it is equally distributed or better distributed? I think this is a legitimate, if I may say, statistical point almost, that needs to be raised. And it would be important, while almost very difficult, it would be important not to be caught in political arguments as to why, we should go one way or the other. Because I think there are sincere, if I may say, objective arguments why sustainability of growth cannot happen by just looking at averages.
Well, that's very interesting. Let's put a pin in that, and we'll come back to that in the third part of this discussion. And we'll ask if you can really be an empiricist and an economist at the same time and stay out of politics anymore, and whether that's one of the things that has changed. So let's move on to the most important and or significant books of the last 10 years. Maria, what do you think?
It's a hard choice. There's been a lot of very interesting books. Most of the books that have been written, economics books that have been written in the last 10 years, were about the crisis and understanding the crisis, how the crisis has been handled in Europe, in the US, different reasons why it happened and all that stuff. I'm going to refrain from quoting some of these books because there is a big competition there. But the one book that stood out for me, and it is a little bit earlier, but if I may quote it, because I was very impressed by this book, is this book by Professors Acemoglu and Robinson, Why Nations Fail.
And why some countries are poor and some countries are prosperous.
It is written by economists, primarily, but it is about sort of what makes economics sustainable, in my view. The fundamental question at the book was why nations succeed, some nations succeed and others fail. Is it just the economics of it? And in fact, they make a very sincere attempt to go deeper there and say, actually, it's not so much about the economics, it's about the institutions behind it. It's about inclusiveness, and it's about having democratic institutions that have the accountability. And this is what, the respect for underlying institutions, fundamental institutions, is the sine qua non. You cannot do without it. In terms of sustaining successful economies. It's been a tremendous book to read, and I would certainly advise anybody to read it.
And has it changed the way you've seen the world?
I think so, yeah. I mean, one of my biggest, objectives in my own research is in where I care a lot about EMU, and I care about the future of Europe. And I've always been arguing that it's crucial that any way forward for a sustainable and long-lasting Europe requires big institutions and institutions that are fundamentally democratically based and with great respect for the rule of law and for good governance. And I think it's not just about the countries around the world. I'm talking about Europe here. We need to come back and look at the quality of our institutions in Europe in order to ensure that we have sustainable economic outcomes.
And you're a Greek economist, and we haven't really mentioned Greece at all so far in this podcast. And I wonder if it makes you feel differently about Greek institutions in the decade before the last one.
I certainly think that one of the reasons why Greece got into troubles is because it had weak institutions. So I would argue that one of the things that Greece should correct for a sustainable development in the future and for a sustainable road out of the crisis is strengthening those institutions, strengthening democratic institutions, the rule of law, the freedom of the press. These things, they are not negotiable in my view, and it would serve Greece and it would serve a lot of other countries very well.
Okay, so your book of the decade is Why Nations Fail. Nicholas, what is yours?
So it was a difficult selection, and for me, Why Nations Fail was also very much high up there in the list. But in the end, I chose a different one, which is Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow. And the reason why I chose this is because it's not just, I think, a tremendous book, but also because it really influenced my thinking. And maybe a bit on the background on the book. So Daniel Kahneman, he's a psychologist, actually, not an economist. He won in 2002 the Nobel Prize for basically being one of the most influential people in the creation of what's called behavioral economics. So this kind of going away from this assumption from rational agents, but actually thinking in how people make cognitive biases, how they think, actually different than maybe our assumption economics from rationality.
People are not fully rational, and they make many choices that if they reflected upon them, they would do differently.
And this book is It describes the human brain as being from two parts. One part, the one system one, which is kind of the intuitive, the fast one, where you actually makes fast decisions, normally your reaction, which is very emotional and is not very rational. And then you have system two, which is kind of the part of the brain that we use to think through problems, which takes much more energy. And kind of the story of the book is that in most questions, we really much rely on our intuitive thinking. And it goes about how this leads to biases in our thinking and bias in misjudgments. And for me personally, the book it's kind of a testament of the rise of behavioral economics in the field of economics, but also it's really about these biases. And it's something that personally, I think as empiricist economists, we struggle with every day, not just with our own, basically that we look for data that confirms our intuitions, and this is a big risk for us.
Absolutely.
We want to be correct, so we really have to fight these biases. But also this is something that we have with the conversation, with the public, with the policymakers, that they have a idea what they want to hear, and then actually to convince them otherwise and to show them that this is what they think is intuitive, it might not be true. I think this is something that we deal with every day. So
of course, a lot of sort of post-war economics in Europe and America relies on the idea that consumers and voters are rational actors.
Yeah.
And that the market is based on that. But if you take thinking fast and slow into account, it kind of challenges that idea. Does it suggest that economists and policymakers should be more paternalistic?
That's a difficult one. This is a criticism that is raised against behavioral economics quite a lot, especially against the field of what calls nudging. So kind of using these cognitive biases to influence their behavior. So the classical examples that people, they like the idea of saving for pensions, but then they don't. So but you can put contracts in a way that basically by signing your employment contract, you sign up by default of paying in the future. And of course you influence people by that. Is that paternalistic? Personally, I believe not making a choice is as much as choice of than making a choice. So basically by choosing it, you always have to choose a default. If it's a policy or non-policy, you do always influence people. And in the end, if you want to make enlightened and informed decisions, as a regulator, I think you have to take these things into account. And so I think it's valuable.
Well, it's interesting because I think it's possible that one of the themes of the last decade, maybe when we look back at it, is a kind of return to paternalism in economic policy making. I was thinking about this today because me and Guntram, we went to interview Marguerite Vestager at the Commission, and I was remembering that, you know, Donald Trump said that she hated America more than any other person he's ever met.
She hates the United States perhaps worse than any person I've ever met.
Wow.
And so these two people are completely diametrically opposed ideologically. But if you think about what they've both done in the last few years, is they've really sort of brought back strength to governance. And they've treated markets with, you know, the invisible hand, with almost an iron fist, and they've completely changed it. And there seems to be an appetite now for more paternalism, almost maybe more protectionism in some ways. If you see the trade war, and that would have been unthinkable 10 years ago, when almost everything was left to the market and assumed that would take care of everything.
Yeah, that comes back to my original point that I think that sort of now we are in this wave of more appetite for regulation. That regulation is about, you know, holding your hand and sort of guiding you through the economy, as it were. I mean, I think you need to allow first for the fact that, you know, there are waves in these things. So the 80s and the 90s were deregulation waves. Now we are on the opposite of that. But it's also, you know, you have to remember we are, still in the midst of how we deal with a very big shock, a very big financial crisis that has left an incredible footprint in the way that we approach our economic thinking. So I'm not surprised about that. I'm sure it's going to peter out eventually. I think what's important in the process, whichever way we are riding, not to forget that there are benefits and costs, both from deregulation and both from regulation. So knowing not to go when to stop and not to go too far is really the aim of the game here. But I think we are seeing a more appetite for regulation, and that's not necessarily paternalistic. It is actually, you know, a reaction.
Mm. Obviously, it's very tempting to discuss Capital in the 21st Century by Thomas Piketty, but I'm sure anybody who's made a decision to listen to this podcast is already very well aware of what that book's about and how significant it was. So I thought if I was going to put one forward, I would say that a strange choice for the most influential book of this decade might actually be The Uninhabitable Earth by David Wallace Wells, not because it's had an incredible impact so far, but I can imagine that a new generation of people taking an interest in economics and policy will be reading that book now, and they'll be thinking about how effective free markets are and how effective democracy is in actually combating the climate crisis.
Everything we do over the next century will be conducted in the theater of climate change.
Can the climate crisis be effectively controlled within global free markets and by democracy? If you look at the stats so far, it would suggest not, and that's a huge challenge for political philosophy. And so it's going to be really interesting to see how people react to those ideas in the years ahead and how that redefines freedom in the years ahead. So let's move on to the third part of our discussion and discuss how the world has changed economics and the field of economics. And you were saying earlier that it's become harder, perhaps, for economists to be perceived as being kind of apolitical and driven purely by facts. Obviously, economists are humans with their own biases and so on. But I guess in many ways, economists are sort of subconsciously attached by the public and politicians to certain positions. And so they'll be like social democratic economists, and they'll be kind of more libertarian economists and so on. There's the whole political scale of economists now, and people might see economists almost as sort of activists in some ways. Has it become harder to be an economist?
Probably. I don't know. What I will say is that economists did go through a crisis. The profession itself. It has had the need to go back and reconsider, are we sort of doing things correctly? If you miss a crisis of the magnitude that we had in 2008, 2009, then you have to go back and consider, am I looking at the right things here? There were visible imbalances that we simply ignored as insignificant. And then we were very surprised that when they unraveled. So, I think the crisis as a profession, the economics as a profession went through this crisis, and it's important to go back and consider, are we doing this correctly, and what do we need to do differently? Economics is certainly something that attracts political arguments, but I don't think that's unique to economics. I think medicine attracts political arguments and other sciences as well as social sciences. I think it still is the role of a social scientist to try and have an objective, as much of an objective research to that. Don't pretend that we don't have political ideals that are driving our views. I don't think we should do that. But in as much as we can contain them, it's crucial that we sort of try and find objective arguments of moving these things forward. But if I may offer a few thoughts in terms of what, what economics needs to do differently, perhaps, as we move sort of in the new decade. I think the choice of book that Nicholas chose is, of course, telling in itself the need not only to consider consumers rational beings, but also to allow for the fact that they are irrational and they can be persistently irrational. I think guiding the policy discussions with that lens, from that lens, is crucial for the design of good policies in the future. And that plays a little bit in this obsession that economics has with mathematization. Mathematics in economics is very good. It's a very good way of doing thought experiments, but we mustn't get stuck with the predictions. The clarity of numbers doesn't necessarily mean clarity in policies. There's always nuances, there's always assumptions, and it's crucial for the profession to be critical about these assumptions, look at as many different models as possible, and always take model results with a pinch of salt, and so allow for the things that we cannot put in the models to also influence policy decisions, simply because we cannot model everything. I think that's an important thing, and I'm hoping that economics will make a difference there. I'll ask Nicholas to contribute. I'll come back.
Yeah. So basically, I would just add on the last point. I think in academic research, the biggest trend I would see is probably the increase in empirical work. So that in the past, we still have the same models we still use, or we still have a lot of model work. But I think in the if you look at the publications, probably what you would see, or what I think you would see, is that the number of studies or the number of empirical work, so the importance of empirical work in economics has increased quite a lot in the last decades. And which probably, by background, I did macro and did theory and I did models, and it's a lot of work I really enjoy. But I think it's probably a good thing that we have in the past, we have maybe relied too much on our model and our assumptions, and we had had too little check them back up with like data. And I think now we see more and more actually that data plays an important role. And this is probably also backed up by just the availability of data, that there are now more and more micro data sets where you can do much more finely grained analysis. You can do more finely grained models, but also more finely grained micro analysis.
And in fact, if I may add to that, because I think that's exactly where the future is, and I mean the availability of also big data is going to change the way that we approach economic policy. We are going to be looking a lot more as of, you know, big data sets that have been scraped from the internet to try and sort of understand behaviors in ways that we couldn't before with very limited data sets. So a very big innovation in this respect is going to be the way that economics uses big data to contribute to policy.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I remember Alan Greenspan, one of his arguments for not worrying too much about the economy in the 1990s was that it was okay this time, even if some of the conditions looked a little bit like the 1920s, it was okay because the computers were so advanced and sophisticated that nothing that terrible could ever happen because everything was so well calculated. And we just had the new world of digital, the new digital economy that was emerging with the internet was creating productivity in ways that the government couldn't even understand, and it must be real because the growth was coming in. I remember, I mean, Alan Greenspan, he used to sit and go through all this economic data while he was sitting in the bath, and he couldn't understand why there was so much growth and so little growth in productivity, which isn't too much too different to where we are now with AI and productivity. And there was this kind of assumption that, oh, it must be okay because the numbers won't lie. But there were things hidden within that that came back to haunt us, which I think is very interesting. So there could be this complacency when it comes to big data.
Exactly, exactly. So I think it's important not to be complacent. We've learned that lesson the hard way, as it were. And you know, we need to look at different places. I mean, I think we were just looking at small number of places that we were used to looking at. But it's important not to just look there. It's important to broaden the vistas here and sort of look at other things that we don't expect with different lenses as well, which also the other thing that I think economics should do more of, and I think is realizing that, is the interdisciplinary part, important it is to be interdisciplinary in the way that we approach economic questions. So, you know, just don't rely on just, you know, your own ideas. Talk to different people, hear different voices, understand different things.
Should we be worried about the reputation of economics? If you think about the kind of the conditions that created the crisis in 2007, 2008, they had a seal of approval from the economic community. And then the austerity policies that followed in Europe and Britain, they had a seal of approval from the economic party, and they hurt a lot of people and we're still not really sure about how effective they are. We probably won't know until historians look into this in decades to come. But it does mean that, it feels like to me that at least in America and Britain, and I'm sure in Europe as well, it's easier for politicians to ignore economists than possibly, at least at any time in my lifetime. And so I wonder what, if anything, economists can do. And it may just be that we live in a polarized time where people, as you say, you know, they look for evidence that confirms their pre-existing beliefs. And that's very hard for a profession that wants to be seen as neutral and evidence-based. But can the reputation of economics recover in the years to come?
Oh, I certainly hope so.
Yes, yes. I mean, it's always difficult to predict the future, I guess. I believe... So I don't think that the crisis of populism we have is a crisis of economics. I think there's a lot of things to be wanted, as in any field, in economics, but I wouldn't go as... I think it's more a political thing that we are in a very difficult political environment for whatever. I mean, the same is true for vaccination. And I mean, for other fields, for medicine, you have this whole movement
against... Do you think there's a link between inequality and populism?
Certainly. So I believe if so, the people had the I think especially in Anglo-Saxon countries, so in UK and US, there's the feeling among many people that the politics that were done were not to their benefit, and there's a good argument that they were not to their benefit, and I think that kind of quite a lot supported populist movements and supported this kind of populism that we have now, which is it the fault of economics that economics argue too much for in German we call it neoliberal politics. No, like I don't think so. I'm not sure. I'm not convinced. But
well, again, I mean, I think that if we leave the politics out of it, because I mean, I think that's if you're looking about the future of the profession, it shouldn't be guided by political tendencies, right? It should be guided by sort of the deeper sort of needs that the science and the social science needs to address. There is interesting, I think, research that is actually through the use of big data and new techniques. There's interesting research that is coming out that is telling us that by comparison to other sciences, social sciences like economics, is less inclusive. It tends to sort of it's sort of inward looking rather than outward looking. So I think one of the things that the economics could do is sort of you know, reach out and look at other disciplines, be affected by different methodologies. And dare I say also, and as a woman, I think to make this point that I mean, you know, there is very few women that actually progress in the field of economics. And you know, you've got to ask the question: why aren't women interested in economics? I mean, women ought to be interested in sort of you know, and the subject of economics. And I think this inclusiveness, this idea that we care about averages, we don't look at distribution elements. These are types of things that women don't look for, and therefore get discouraged on the day one when all we teach is about sort of how can we do better, but not necessarily better for all. I think these types of things would be good for the future, for sustainable growth. It would be good for the reputation of economics. It would be good for inclusiveness.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? So the idea is that the subjects that economists have been focusing on have been, for some reason, preferred by men or dictated by men, and therefore there's not enough of a precedent for women who might be interested in other elements of economics to get involved. I mean, I know that 60% of the listeners to this podcast are men, which is a lot better than The Economist newspaper, which I used to work for, about 80%
of our readers. Well, that means that also 40% of our listeners are women, which is much better than the population of economist women in the world.
Yeah, also, I would, if I can push back a bit on that, I would be careful if branding topics as male or female. So I think there is, you have within the field of economics, you have that more women work in some fields. So if you go to family economics, gender economics, you have much more women working, and the ratio is very differently in macroeconomics. Yeah. And I think I believe that it has more to do with the kind of environment of macroeconomics, that it's very, very competitive in a bad sense. It's very tough environment. It's like boys clubs sometimes, almost, you know, some of the seminars and workshops. It's like friend groups that know each other from, I don't know.
You think it's more of a cultural thing as opposed to the topics we choose to write about and talk about?
I mean, probably there's difference in interests and topics, but I think there's also something much more underlying. I'm happy if family economics gets more in my light, but I think the bigger question is actually how do we change the structural impediment for women to make a career in central banking, for instance. If you look at the gender ratio in central banks, it's just horrible.
No, that's true. And unfortunately, this is actually self-perpetuating because, I mean, you know, we all need role models. And, you know, if you're a woman economist, you don't have role models. This is why I cannot emphasize how important it is for women to have people like Christine Lagarde becoming the president of the ECB.
Let me suggest that we follow a girl, a young girl.
It matters to women.
Girl.
It matters to everybody, but it seems women don't have role models at this field. They just don't progress in this respect. So I think that's correct. And there are many reasons why women just don't choose to go to economics. And I think there is a big effort, actually, and a very welcome effort, both sides of the Atlantic, actually, to try and change that, try and analyze why is it, what is it that we can do better in this respect to actually attract women and retain women. Because I think economics actually suffers on both fields. It doesn't attract as many, and from those it does attract, it doesn't retain them. So it would be important to sort of, you know, for economics to become more inclusive, to save the reputation of economics, dare I say, to try and sort of become a slightly more inclusive when it comes to diversity, and not just women, but also other parts of diversity.
Mm. Well, I've been interviewing academics for the last 6 or 7 years now, and I know that nothing makes you more uncomfortable than asking you to make predictions. So I won't ask you to make any very specific predictions, but I will ask you to talk about the kind of themes and challenges that you think will define the next 10 years. So what do you think those will be?
Well, I certainly believe the issue of climate, how to finance climate, how to reverse the climate change is going to have huge repercussions, and therefore will be discussed at all lengths in any economic circles. So I think the way to finance the greening of the economy, ensuring that we have equitable distributive outcomes, and how to ensure that this happens at the speed that the society can take are going to be pivotal in all economics discussions. In Europe, we will also be thinking about our place in the world. And economics is a very important component of that discussion. And it's not just economics, it's other discussions. But economics is a big one. And therefore, when you start talking about economics, you need to find a ways of ensuring that Europe is a credible economic partner. So I think in the years to come, this commission and probably the next one, these topics will be big on the economic agenda.
So if you're just starting to study economics now, you do well to be reading about European Green Deal and economic sovereignty in Europe, because those are the issues that are going to...
You do well if you follow Bruegel.com.
And if you subscribe to this podcast. Nicholas, what do you think?
No, I would totally subscribe to that. I think the big... Maybe the there's like 3-4 big topics that will stay with us, and climate is going to be probably the top one. I think international order. If the U.S. is retreating, if China is rising the way it's doing now, what does it mean for us? And maybe also if the growth period of China ends, this will also have great challenges for the world. Mm-hmm. So I think this is one. If I can add to that, maybe I think the demographical question is understudied.
You've been watching events in Paris, and you're worried about how we're going to pay for pensions.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think we have. I mean, the effect on growth is so basically the European countries. All European countries are aging almost. All of them. And our pension system is not built for that. It will mean that just by demographics, growth will decline, growth will decrease. And are we prepared for that? I don't think so.
Well, that's interesting because, obviously we've been talking about the European Green Deal a lot, and we wonder if there'll be like Gilets Jaunes-esque movements all over the world in the years to come. And it could be that the current strikes over pensions in Paris are also a thing that could, escalate and travel. And I guess, I mean, one of the aspects there is that there's some criticism that those pensions were unsustainable in the first place, and that there's going to be, there's a generation now who have had it quite good politically compared to some other generations, and eventually the austerity, or at least modernity, is going to reach them too, and that's going to happen over the next decade. And so far, austerity, at least in Europe, has mainly been felt by young people and women and the poor and so on. There's this generation of boomers and others who are now going to start feeling it as well, and when they do, they're a huge electoral constituency. Things could get quite chaotic.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a complex question, but I certainly think the issue of demographics is a very important one for the sustainability of our finances in the future. And how do you consciously take a step back in the generosity of a wealth system and maintain political stability? I think that's going to be an important one. But, I mean, the numbers are what they are. They don't add up. We are aging. We're having less children. And we cannot be as generous in the way that we support welfare systems. So this idea that the next generation is the first time that the next generation, in many generations, is going to be worse than the previous generation, that is a very hard realization that we have to reckon with. And it will have ramifications beyond just economics. I agree with Nicholas. This is one to watch.
That's definitely true. One of the things David Wallace Wells argues in The Uninhabitable Earth is that this expectation that each generation will be better off than the one before it is something of a historical aberration that started when we started extracting fossil fuel.
Interesting.
That could only ever last so long. So, but also in terms of the trade war, might we have peace in our time?
I mean, I think we need. This is early days, if I may. And Nicholas, who's a specialist here, he will have views on this. I think a lot has to do with tactics that are coming from the U.S. I don't think that the tactics of the U.S. and the strategy of the U.S. are necessarily aligned. So I would hold my breath here and just wait, understand what the U.S. is doing, why it's doing, how far it's going to go. I mean, the latest news coming from the U.S. are they're maybe moving us in a different direction. I think we just need to hold our breath here. The benefits of trade are indisputable. If we can correct for the distribution issue, then we should not throw away the baby together with the bathwater. I will just be cautious here and ensure that we can have the benefits while minimizing the costs.
Nicholas, world peace?
I'm an optimist by nature, so I hope. So I think there's a lot of, if we went 10 years back, if you would have asked, so I think the 2000s were like the most peaceful decade in human history or something like this. And then I meant
in terms of trade, not...
No, but then Syrian war happens, Arab Spring happens. So it's difficult to predict if there will be peace in the world. But I hope in terms of trade wars. I think there's a case for free trade in the world is as strong as ever. And so I hope that that we come back from zero-sumness. If the U.S. actually wants that, or if actually the people in the U.S. that are more in conflict or want more in conflict, the confrontation with China are stronger. I don't know, but yeah, I hope.
I think as economists, our role is very much to drive that message as often as we can. That, I mean, you know, there's good things to be had here, and you know, make sure that you do this in ways that are sustainable.
And on that thought, we'll bring this whirlwind of a podcast to an end. I've had a lot of fun doing it. Not much you can rely on in this chaotic, crazy world. No one knows what's going to happen next, but you can rely on us to keep making podcasts. So,
and other than, you know, also wish our audience a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Yeah, that too. Yeah.
Why not? Happy holidays.
And you will be hearing from us in the years and decades ahead. Goodbye.